Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, July 10th, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone will be discussing ABC versus Aereo, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in the closing moments of its just-concluded term. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're happy to welcome back to today's call our expert. He's going to make opening remarks in just a moment of about 15 or so minutes. He is Professor Mark Schultz. He's Associate Professor and Director of Faculty Development at Southern Illinois University and Senior Scholar and Co-Director of Academic Programs at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason University School of Law. As I mentioned, he's going to describe the case and give opening remarks of about 15 minutes. After that, as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please do be ready with your questions. And with that, Professor Schultz, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. Now, this opinion came out about 2 weeks ago, so I suppose you could call this an early second look at the opinion. I have the benefit of seeing others' immediate reactions, but perhaps not the benefit of extended study and development, watching developments. However, because of that, I have an opportunity to describe some of the immediate reactions and respond briefly to them, and to respond to one new early development as of yesterday, with Aereo announcing plans to attempt to continue on in its business with a new legal strategy. So I'll talk about that. But first, let's get to the facts. So Aereo is a company who arguably engaged in technological innovation, but definitely engaged in legal innovation. Its system was really the product of legal engineering rather than truly innovative engineering. There were parts of it that were quite interesting. Let me describe it. So Aereo developed in response to a perceived loophole in the Copyright Act. Generally, you can't take other people's content and redistribute it without permission from the copyright owner, and thus the requirement is the copyright owner usually asks to be paid. However, what had developed, that there developed a line of cases and legal doctrine that gave Aereo the belief that it had an opportunity to design its system around the law such that it wouldn't be considered to be the party responsible for redistributing these works. Let me get into the statutory language precisely that applies here. So the question in the case as presented to the Supreme Court was whether Aereo was publicly performing works that it was rebroadcasting to its customers. What Aereo had done is set up a system that of very small antennas, about the size of a dime. It would set these dime-sized antennas up on large arrays in local markets and capture the over-the-air broadcast signal. It would then send that over-the-air broadcast signal to subscribers and charge them for it. Now, one might ask why it was setting up the system of very small antennas. The reason was because Aereo was building an architecture in which it arguably was engaging in a one-to-one transmission. If we think of a performance, we think of one person performing to many, a performer standing on a stage performing to an audience, a terrestrial radio station broadcasting over the airwaves to an audience of potentially thousands or millions. What Aereo was doing, because of its architecture, was able to assign an individual antenna to each customer, who received their own unique copy of the programs. And what Ariel argued further was that it was doing the equivalent of providing an antenna with a very long cable attached to it. And it was not, in fact, redistributing the programs. It was just simply renting antenna space, and that the user was choosing which programs to watch or record. There was a DVR function in here as well. And Aereo had nothing to do with it. Aereo was simply a passive system providing an antenna. And this was the basis in which Aereo argued that it was not subject to the Copyright Act and did not have to get permission, because ultimately the end user, we as individuals, have a implied license or rights to receive free over-the-air broadcast television. It's there for the taking, and if Aereo is simply supplying an antenna, it's not actually performing or transmitting the signal. So the Copyright Act indeed has a public performance right, that's the exclusive right of the owner, of the copyright owner, section 106, the exclusive right to perform the copyrighted work publicly, and the Act further contains something called the transmit clause that says the public performance right includes the right to transmit or otherwise communicate a performance of the copyrighted work to the public by means of any device or process, whether the members of the public capable of receiving the performance receive it in the same place or in separate places and at the same time or at different times. So the question was whether this clause and the public performance right applied to Aereo. And at both the district and appellate court levels, Aereo won. However, the Supreme Court reversed the Second Circuit, and thus defeated Aereo's argument was defeated. So Justice Breyer wrote for the majority of six justices, and Justice Breyer showed little patience for the legal engineering in which Aereo engaged. He dismissed the focus on the behind-the-scenes way, this is a quote from Justice Breyer, but the behind-the-scenes way in which Aereo delivers television programming to its viewer screens. He noted that Aereo had the same commercial aims and provided the same experience as any other consumer TV provider, specifically as any cable system. Justice Breyer asked, why should any of these technological differences matter? Why would a subscriber who wishes to watch a television show care much whether images and sounds are delivered to a screen via a large multi-subscriber antenna or one small dedicated antenna? So ultimately, Justice Breyer focused on the similarity to cable TV systems, and he further looked to the legislative intent underlying the 1976 Copyright Act, which Congress explicitly set out to overrule previous Supreme Court decisions to essentially alter the Copyright Act because of prior Supreme Court decisions that had exempted cable TV systems from the Copyright Act. So Justice Breyer, relying on this legislative intent and the similarity of Aereo to a cable system, he described it as the substantial similarity of Aereo to cable TV systems, the court held that Aereo was indeed publicly performing the programs it was retransmitting to its customers. Now, Justice Breyer was clearly concerned about the implications of the holding for cloud computing and other technologies, so the court repeatedly attempted to reassure that the scope of the holding was narrow, and it concluded with the statement that given the limited nature of this holding, the court does not believe its decision will discourage the emergence or use of different kinds of technologies. Justice Scalia dissented, joined by Justices Thomas and Alito. And briefly, to describe the dissent, first of all, clearly, as anyone who knows Justice Scalia's jurisprudence knows, that he was not impressed with Justice Breyer's reliance on legislative history. More to the point, though, he complained of guilt by resemblance, essentially the fact that Aereo resembled a cable system was not enough to persuade him that Aereo should be treated as one under the Copyright Act. And indeed, he said that although that he was not clearly was not sympathetic to what Aereo was doing, he saw that as a matter for Congress to fix, not the court. He particularly complained that the decision blurred the distinction between secondary and direct liability under copyright law, because he, as the dissent pointed out, essentially Justice Breyer's opinion fails to point out exactly where the infringement occurs. What Justice Breyer did is more in the nature of drawing a large circle around the entire system and saying it looks like a public performance somewhere in there that's happening, and thus there's infringement, without identifying where the particular instance of infringement, in this case the unauthorized public performance, is occurring.
Mark, okay. Mark, this is Dean breaking in here. You're breaking up a little bit. I don't know if there's a better part of your room you could be in, but your voice is sort of becoming digitized.
I'm sorry. Is that better?
Yeah, I think that might be better. Go ahead.
Okay. I do apologize. There are I'll briefly describe a few critiques and reactions to the opinion. Of course, there were fairly strong critiques and reactions from the losing side, people claiming that the court was going to harm innovation, that the court had made copyright law terribly unclear and would have a chilling effect on startups. I think some of the more interesting, less rhetorical reactions are the following. One common reaction was that this was a very much an instrumentalist opinion, that the court did not approve of what Aereo was doing, wanted to stop it, saw what Aereo was doing as too clever by half, and found a way to stop it, but was also concerned with potential effects on cloud computing, and so tried to craft a holding that narrowly addressed the subject matter and did not have further implications. However, a response to that take by the Electronic Frontier Foundation and many others was that the court has injected some ambiguity into what was once a clearer standard as to who is liable. One complaint particularly that attorneys from the Electronic Frontier Foundation made is that a future lawyer counseling a new startup business is going to have some difficulty counseling whether their business model of using television signals is permissible given the court's explicit reliance on case-by-case decision making. They critiqued the opinion as offering vague criteria. However, others, such as Professor David Post, saw the decision as narrow, limited to what you may or may not do with over-the-air broadcast signals, and thus unlikely to have a broader effect on innovation. One take I thought was particularly interesting by Terry Hart of the Copyright Alliance was that the court, one way to understand the court's opinion and perhaps offer some greater certainty in the future to future innovators, as the Electronic Frontier Foundation was concerned with, was to understand this as understand the area of opinion as looking to the principles of proximate cause. That Aereo was that although copyright infringement is a strict liability offense, courts in tort cases still must determine often must determine whether a particular actor is responsible for the harm incurred in the case and whether strict liability should apply. And in that regard, he said that the court offered some principles such as the ability to control the infringement through physical ownership of the facilities, who actually provides the work, in this case Aereo, and they were in the best position to know whether somebody possessed the rights, and looking at the range of use of the services. Aereo was specifically set up as a television service to redistribute broadcast signals. And so there was a foreseeability and intent that the purpose for which it would be used was definitely reperforming signals. And thus Mr. Hart argues that looking to these principles, there is both a limiting and useful principle in the Aereo opinion that can be applied to further copyright law. I'll look to one last take on this, and I think that this last take is particularly insightful. Gus Hurwitz, writing for the American Enterprise Institute, Professor Gus Hurwitz, who's a communications expert, argued that, as communications law expert, argued that Aereo was really properly a decision about communications law policy, and that the court instead focused on the issue of public performance, because that's how the parties chose to frame the issue. They apparently both wanted to avoid other issues in the case, but other potential issues. But what Professor Hurwitz points out is that under Section 111 of the Copyright Act, the Copyright Act offered the court an opportunity to look to the fact that those who make secondary transmissions of broadcast signals are liable for copyright infringement unless a particular statutory exemption applies. And as Professor Hurwitz argued, clearly what Aereo does appears to be a secondary transmission. The primary transmission comes from the broadcast network. There are some reasons why both parties wish to avoid this, because it likely put them into the discussion of whether Aereo was cable system or not under Section 111, which brings me to my final point and an interesting recent development within the last 24 hours. You see, Section 111 of the Copyright Act provides for a compulsory license for cable systems. A local cable system may rebroadcast the content on broadcast signals, and it may do so freely under compulsory license. In other words, it's allowed to do so, but it must pay a statutory fee mandated under the Copyright Act. Now, Aereo has now declared that it intends to pursue this strategy. Aereo, prior to losing in the Supreme Court, vehemently argued that it was not a cable system and that it owed no fees, statutory or otherwise. Now Aereo has taken a 180-degree turn, and as of yesterday is claiming that it is a cable system, that it meets the definition of cable system under the Copyright Act, and I think it has a reasonable argument for doing so, and thus is subject to the compulsory license and need only pay statutory fees. Now, there's a further wrinkle here that isn't being mentioned in the news coverage and isn't being mentioned immediately by Aereo. A cable system may indeed rebroadcast under a compulsory license and only have to pay the statutory fee to the content owners. So the creator of a television program gets the statutory fee mandated by the statute. However, under the Communications Act, different from the Copyright, the Communications Act, cable systems or multi-channel video providers must get retransmission consent to rebroadcast the signal from the broadcaster, right? So we have two statutory schemes. Copyright Act mandates the rights of copyright owners, who are the people who create the television programs, whereas the Communications Act mandates the rights of the local broadcasters, and the local broadcasters have the right to charge for the retransmission of their signal, and indeed, that retransmission requires consent. Aereo, of course, is not addressing the Communications Act in its latest arguments. One can only speculate why, and it may be because there are two different definitions of cable system, of to whom each act applies. And Aereo arguably comes under the Copyright Act definition pretty comfortably, and probably pretty comfortably comes under the Communications Act definition as well. But it appears that I could only speculate that Aereo perhaps will try to argue that it may pay the compulsory license but need not enter into retransmission consent negotiations and pay a negotiated fee to the broadcasters. It's likely that the broadcasters would not give retransmission consent. I'm only speculating here. My guess is that for business reasons, they would prefer to retain control over their transition to internet video and develop their own services rather than work with Aereo. But perhaps they might work it out. But for now, Aereo appears to be relying solely on a Section 111 argument. That Section 111 argument also, of course, is an opportunity to limit damages as well for its past conduct, and that may be part of what it's attempting to do. And with that, I'll stop and turn it over to Dean. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Schultz. We're going to open the floor to audience questions at this point. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for Professor Mark Schultz, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see who might ring in, a reminder to our audience to check the Federalist Society's new website, newly relaunched website, and our Teleform page for a schedule of upcoming Teleform conference calls. Let me ask you, Professor Schultz, the split on the court, were you surprised by how the justices lined up, number one? And number two, does it say anything in your mind about future cases in copyright or patent law or IP generally that might come before the court?
As to the first question, the split was a bit surprising, not completely surprising. What was surprising about it is I think if somebody told most observers, experienced observers, that Aereo was coming out and that Justice Breyer wrote the Aereo opinion, they would have expected it, the majority, to go against the broadcasters and the content owners, because Justice Breyer has generally not been very friendly to IP rights in recent years. And in fact, in a long time ago, when he started his career as an academic, one of his famous articles, law review articles in the early 70s, was a very skeptical take on copyright law. So that was perhaps surprising, and there's been a variety of speculation that Justice Breyer was engaging in horse trading of some sort, perhaps trading of votes in other cases. I think that's a little bit of slightly hysterical speculation, candidly, because I think I can't imagine anyone was passionate enough about this case to trade votes, even if such things go on. What I could imagine, though, is that he took the opportunity to write the opinion in order to limit its potential scope, and in order to try to avoid the dangerous implications, what he might have seen as dangerous implications for cloud computing, and indeed what the dissent saw as dangerous implications for cloud computing. And when you frame the issue as a statutory interpretation case, as opposed to a pure copyright case, perhaps the lineup doesn't surprise at all. We're all, I think, the sort of audience these calls draw are familiar with Justice Scalia's views on legislative intent and Justice Thomas and Alito's views on statutory interpretation. And so I'm not surprised in that sense once you frame the case that way, as opposed to, say, being a case about first principles and property rights. As for future copyright cases, I think because of the nature of this case, the very technical nature of it, and the complex statutory regime, I'm not sure it says anything about future cases. I think, interestingly enough, in copyright, we've had one of the less ideological divides in copyright cases. And for example, Justice Ginsburg is often more strongly in favor of rights, and she's more typically on the opposite side of Justice Breyer. Justice Ginsburg's daughter is a famous copyright scholar who's generally favorable toward rights holders, and people sometimes remark that Justice Breyer favors his own scholarship and Justice Ginsburg favors her daughter's. So we have a kind of interesting and unusually non-ideological mix on copyright cases.
Once again, if you have a question for Professor Mark Schultz, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Professor, you mentioned damages as an aspect of the case, and maybe the way Aereo is undertaking its latest moves might be in order to limit damages. How are damages calculated in any event in a case like this? You can almost make an argument that the broadcasters can go back to their advertisers and claim wider dispersion of this material and therefore jack up the advertising price. It's true that Aereo is making money itself on the rebroadcast, but it's not clear to me that that the broadcasters are damaged, and maybe their profits could even be enhanced if Aereo brings their signals to another, you know, tens of thousands more people or millions more people.
Sure. Well, I guess there's a few responses. I'll give the technical one and then respond to the economic argument you're making. So under the Copyright Act, there's two types of damages available. One is, like in any other action like this, as you'd imagine, there are actual damages, which can be challenging to calculate, perhaps for some of the reasons you've cited. However, the Copyright Act also provides for statutory damages. And statutory damages are potentially quite high, especially for infringing, intentional infringement. So one could receive well over $100,000 per work infringed intentionally. In any event, even for lesser offenses, for non-intentional infringement, there's still a mandatory statutory amount awarded. Now, it's a jury issue, and so it's somewhat of a black box. Nobody knows what you might get a jury to award if the damages question is brought before a jury. But the damages awards potentially are quite high if one invokes statutory damages. My suspicion here is that this case was more likely about control and future, and the broadcasters wanting control of their future, and they're likely not out for blood, and not necessarily seeking high damages, but certainly Aereo's tactic here, if a court accepted it, that they were subject to Section 111, would greatly limit the potential damages here. So that's what's going on here. As to the general economic principle you described, the answer is sure, maybe. It's one of those empirically difficult to calculate questions, because yes, perhaps more people saw the advertising, but there are other things that the broadcasters lost control of. Specifically, they don't forget the broadcasters, and the broadcasters are ultimately largely vertically integrated in some way, shape, or form. So the copyright owners are often the same as broadcasters, for example, in the case of Disney and Comcast, Comcast NBC, and Fox. They all both produce programs and distribute programs and broadcast programs. They receive retransmission fees. And so Aereo was skirting the payment of retransmission fees to broadcasters and ultimately hurting the copyright owners in that way, through that indirect channel, and also just potentially causing them to lose control of a subscription TV business model that they're trying to pursue through venues like Hulu and others. So perhaps this increased their advertising revenue, arguably increased their audience, but it also potentially hurts other revenue sources. So the effects are ambiguous.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, and then our lines are open. Let's take our first question. The caller might be you might have muted your own telephone, caller.
Oh, apologies. Hi, my name is Lee Dunn, and I have a question for the professor on how this case may impact new technologies going forward. Do you think this case will have new technologies look to be defined by existing statutes instead of sort of pushing the limits, or how do you think this will play out with future technologies? I mean, obviously Aereo never would have had these problems if it had decided early on that it should be treated like a cable company and not classified as some other type of service.
Right. So it's hard to say what the future impact is, except I think one thing's clear. I think everyone agrees that if you're going to grab over-the-air signals and resell them to an audience, whatever the technological architecture you're using, you're going to have a problem, or more specifically, not a problem. You're going to have to get the consent of the copyright owners and perhaps the broadcasters. I think are certainly the broadcasters, but. Beyond that, it's hard to say whether this opinion offers general principles because, as I did have the opportunity to say earlier, I think Justice Breyer was trying to craft a narrow opinion that have a lot of implications. There are some. With that said, there's over the coming months and years, I'm sure courts and scholars and policy advocates will try to craft some new law out of this decision. It certainly provides that opportunity, and I think it certainly might give pause to some people who want to use other people's content to build their business model and try to attempt to legally engineer around copyright law. It looks like the court's sending a clear signal that it's not going to look to the technical architecture, but look to the result. Are you taking other people's content and redistributing it? So one could wonder, though, whether that's a bad thing, whether people building business models based on other people's content, perhaps they should pay, but that's perhaps a different discussion. So yes, a Supreme Court decision like this is never without effect. I think because Justice Breyer tried to limit its effect, it may indeed have a somewhat more limited effect than a more sweeping decision would have.
Professor, a lot of the this is Dean Reuter again. A lot of the coverage I've read, at least notes, if not makes a lot about the fact that the technology allowed near real time transmission of the broadcast. Was that important in the decision? It seems to me even some delay would have the same negative effects the court was critical of.
Right. That's an excellent question. So what the court was indeed focusing on was the near real-time transmission and focusing perhaps in the transmit clause's language that it constitutes public performance to transmit the content to more than one person, whether they receive it in the same place or at the same time or different places at different times. So I think that was certainly that was important to the court, and the court wanted to avoid questions of, say, remote DVRs or of other types of services and leave those for another day or for other resolutions. So to the extent that somebody is offering a remote DVR service like Cablevision does, perhaps that is still not subject to the Aereo opinion, because those in the remote DVR service offered by Cablevision is somewhat similar to Aereo. Each subscriber has their own virtual DVR that they control, and it sends them a single copy, makes them a unique copy of the program, and sends it to them. But it's a little different from Aereo's service in that it's not capturing over-the-air broadcast signals and immediately or nearly immediately resending them. So perhaps there's a distinction there, although many think that perhaps following the logic of what the court did here and held here, that kind of a remote DVR system is no longer permissible. It, of course, though, doesn't affect the individual private use of a DVR.
Let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see if we get yet another question from the audience. Let me maybe broaden the discussion here. If you want to duck this question, you can, Professor. But I've noted that there are a lot more IP, patent, copyright cases in the Supreme Court in the past few terms than there have been. I wonder if you want to comment on that. What accounts for that? Is it just the growth of the importance of intellectual property in our economy? Or let me just leave the question there and get your response.
Sure. So I think there it's a function of two things. First, when we look at IP cases, we need to make a distinction between among trademark, copyright, patent cases, and other types of intellectual property cases. The patent appeals all come from the Federal Circuit, and the Supreme Court for well over a decade now has had has been engaged in a long-term attempt to correct the Federal Circuit in its view, I would say. The two courts seem to have fundamentally different approaches to intellectual property cases. The Federal Circuit hears all patent appeals and appears to definitely see itself as a key player in the patent system and tends to favor rule-based decisions, tends to favor certainty, and tends to look at how each decision affects the system, which it well may, because it has to hear all these cases and deal with its results on a daily basis, the results of its opinions on a daily basis. The Supreme Court, more typically, is, of course, gets to choose the cases it takes, wants to get the results right, and tends to favor standards over rules. It doesn't like bright line rules, and it's been engaged in a long corrective of the Federal Circuit, frequently telling the Federal Circuit to stop using bright line rules and engage in the use of standards across a wide variety of patent issues. And so this is really an ongoing debate between two actors, I think, with very different institutional incentives and roles, and it has continued. To the frustration of many, for a variety of reasons, for the uncertainty and disruption it creates in the system, and for the fact that the battle doesn't seem to be over yet. Now, more generally, for taking more IP cases, generally, yes, Dean, I agree. Intellectual property is more important than ever before. By any number of measures, intangible assets have become vastly more important over the past 30 to 40 years. One that I think is particularly interesting is the United Nations a few years back did a calculation of the wealth of nations, essentially. And in looking at several developed countries like the United States and others, the vast majority, like 90% of their wealth, was viewed as intangible. Now, that's not just intellectual property rights. It's know-how, it's human capital, and other things. But what was striking was when you looked at the bar graphs that graphically represented the differences, and you looked at countries like India and China, when it came to their tangible assets, there wasn't a great difference between them and other countries. What was different was intangible assets. We have vastly more intangible assets than many other countries, and thus this has become a key part of our economy and inspires more controversy, and the stakes are higher every year. So yes, we have more IP cases because they're more important than ever before.
Final call for questions. If you have a question, we've still got some time left. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Well, Professor, it looks like we don't have any further questions from our audience. Let me give you a chance to wrap up or express any final thoughts you have before we adjourn.
I guess my final thought is that the most interesting future development here, at least in the immediate future, is the question of whether Aereo can be viewed as a cable system and can take advantage of the compulsory license, and what its next moves are legal in terms of its legal and business strategy with regard to retransmission consent. And meanwhile, though, I'll note that one thing this case wasn't is the death of innovation. There's hundreds of millions of dollars being poured into new investment by broadcasters, by content owners, by new technology companies, all seeking to bring entertainment to the consumer. And if you really take a hard look at things and look past the apocalyptic rhetoric, people ought to realize they have more entertainment at their fingertips than at any other time in human history, and vastly more than they did even 10 years ago. So innovation is continuing, investment is continuing, and it will in this space because there's money to be made. We human beings seem to like to pay to be entertained, so there's money to be made there. And that I think, will continue, notwithstanding any Supreme Court ruling.
Well, my thanks to Professor Mark Schultz. We certainly appreciate your time and your study of this case and your insights as well. To the audience, thank you as well for dialing in, for listening, for participating. A reminder to check the Federalist Society's newly revamped website for a schedule of upcoming teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.